Today is Wednesday. It's August 17th, 2022. It's 2:39 in the afternoon. Now it's 2:41. We've been chatting. Hi, this is John Williams, and this is the Mincing Rascals podcast. You can hear portions of this broadcast on WGN Radio Saturday nights at 8, and listen for me weekdays from 10 to 2 on WGN.
I'm Austin Burke from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Heather Sharon from WTTW News.
I'm John Hansen from Block Club Chicago and WGN Radio.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the nostalgic editor and publisher of the Picayune Sentinel weekly newsletter.
You guys want to guess what he's nostalgic about? I don't know. Let me think. What would he be nostalgic about? Baseball.
Did they change the green M&M again?
I'm nostalgic for the Republican Party that I used to know, that I used to respectfully disagree with and debate issues in a civil manner with. I feel like that Republican Party died last night in Wyoming, if it wasn't already dead. That result with Liz Cheney getting her butt kicked in the primary was just confirmation that the party, if it's not a cult, it's been taken over by a cult. And it wasn't a surprise, but it was still disappointing that and I just don't know what's happened to the soul of that party and where it goes from here. But they are in the grips of this cult of personality of Donald Trump.
It's Wyoming, Eric. I don't know what you expected.
But Wyoming was just the final straw after a bunch of other results. All the other candidates that have been pushed out, the crazy people being nominated all around the country, that Trump's record as an endorser in this primary season has been pretty good, has been really good. And it suggests that the party is still really beholden to him and really in his thrall. I don't know what to make of that. He was not a very good president, even if you're a conservative. He wasn't very effective. He didn't get things done that he said he was going to get done. Why would you want this guy to be your standard bearer again? Why wouldn't you want someone who knows how to get things done, knows how to advance your agenda? You got your three Supreme Court justices, and any Republican would have picked people similar to that. So why do you want this guy coming back and all the chaos that he brings and all the legal exposure that he's now under? I just don't understand that party. I don't understand the thinking of people who are still in that mindset. I've derailed the podcast. We're going to talk about
go figure.
Talk about things, but yeah, that's never happened before.
So. I'm nostalgic for when the podcast wasn't derailed. That was a good time.
about 5 minutes ago.
But you know, this is what I read about Wyoming today, Eric. It is the reddest of states. Trump won Wyoming by a larger percentage than he won any other state. What was it, 43 points over Joe Biden in the election? That Wyoming has 215,000 registered Republicans and 36,000 registered Democrats. And that the Republican Party there is split into two factions, the crazies, and then the traditional Republicans maybe that you are nostalgic about. But you're not surprised that Liz Cheney lost Wyoming, are you?
I'm not.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I actually randomly, this is random, I met a couple from Wyoming, a couple of Republicans. And I met them at the Paris airport coming home from my honeymoon. And we were chatting. And we were very friendly, so we ended up getting onto the conversation because I was curious about Liz Cheney. And at the time, they weren't going to vote for her. I'm sure they didn't yesterday. And the reason they said was inflation and gas prices, and they weren't like that under Trump. And I think that people still connect the economy so tightly. And maybe that was just a guise that they thought was palatable to me, who I was sitting there with my husband after our honeymoon. But that's what they said it was. And they said that they don't like Liz Cheney because she doesn't like Trump. Trump made things better. The economy was great.
No.
I don't know.
Do you suppose
what's really frustrating about that is that her opponent, I was trying to look at this yesterday. I don't think there's any issues on which she differs from Liz Cheney except the Trump issue. So, you know, if the economy was the problem, maybe they just won't vote, or they'll vote for some other. I don't think there's any other candidates in that Republican race, but that was what was so frustrating as someone who isn't really a fan of any other part of Liz Cheney's agenda, is that, you know, they found one person who's worse than her on this one issue, and that person won.
Well, and what's really interesting about Harriet Hagman is that she is a longtime Wyoming Republican sort of stalwart, and she worked in 2016 on behalf of Ted Cruz and was actually one of the leaders of the effort to deny Donald Trump the Republican nomination on the floor of the convention back in 2016. And she called him a racist, she called him a xenophobe, and she said that he would be the ultimate downfall of the Republican Party. Now, of course, she's repudiated all of that, but it's just this exceedingly weird and hard to report accurately dynamic where it's just sort of vibes. It's not like facts or policy. It's just pure vibes. You know, obviously, I think Liz Cheney knew that she was going to lose. She immediately moved Wednesday morning to transform her election committee to a super PAC that can now be used for national races. She's clearly thinking about running for president. And I just think that this is sort of step one in what's next for her. And I think she sees this loss as perhaps more politically valuable to her than a victory would have been, because now she can say, you know, this is the state of the Republican Party. Especially, this has gotten really sort of lost, I think, in like the post-Mar-a-Lago raid of it all. But there was a moment maybe 2 weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago, where sort of the emerging political general consensus was that the Republican Party was moving away from Trump, that the party as a whole was ready for somebody to sort of carry on Trump's policies, whatever they may be, but that they were tired of sort of the drama. And that, of course, has all changed since the raid. And I think it's going to be just one of those little data points as the Republican Party continues to transform.
Yeah. Well, there was an article in the New York Times. Did they just re-elect Donald Trump as a result of this? The momentum just swung his way.
Well, that was David Brooks, and yeah. I have a very firm policy of never believing anything David Brooks.
It was a good headline. But isn't it interesting, too, though, that if you're pining for this sort of bipartisan character like an Adam Kinzinger or a Liz Cheney, they are dyed-in-the-wool Republicans. Eric, this person that you seem to be championing was not somebody you would otherwise champion. Her policies were lockstep with Donald Trump on almost everything.
I admire her character and her courage. I don't admire very many of her policies. The odds of me ever voting for her for president are extremely slim. I respect her. I respect my differences with her. I feel like I can engage creatively and civilly with people who hold her position. She's not going to talk to me directly, but if we are trading views about policy that needs to be enacted and so on, that you can actually talk about that and talk about the way things should be running. But we have this party right now that seems to just be in the thrall of Trump. And so no matter how hypocritical he is, no matter how dishonest he is, no matter how frightening the things that he says are, they don't deviate from him. This recent search at Mar-a-Lago gives Trump some sort of permanent leg up. Right now, his supporters are energized, but they're kind of crazy, and they're threatening the FBI, and they're creating the kind of chaos that I don't think is going to play very well with swing voters. It may excite its base, but in the end, you're going to have to win the suburbs of Philadelphia, the suburbs of Chicago, these places that can go one way or the other. Again, people who voted for Obama, then they voted for Trump, or they voted. You know, there are a lot of people who are like that, who don't want to see four more years of this kind of chaos. And they see with the allegations that are coming forward out of this search, what we've learned from the warrant and Trump's ever-changing excuses. I mean, they're seeing someone who just is completely unfit to be president. And there are alternatives out there. There's Ron DeSantis, who is, I disagree with him on just about everything, but at least he doesn't strike me as someone who is crazy.
For me, it's like I love debating issues with anybody. I love debating people on the other side. I think that's fun, and grab a beer afterwards. But I think where Eric's going, and I think a lot of people go, is that you have to agree on some ground rules, and that is there's not a conspiracy that got Joe Biden into office. Right. I think that and it's really hard to talk to people about that because we can't even agree on just very basic, simple facts. And that has really what is the sad part of this erosion is that because you even see the Senate's got a ton of bipartisan bills done in the past 2 years from the Senate's where you see more level headed conversations happening than the House. It's sad that you can't debate that anymore because debating that stuff is fun.
Friend of mine sent me a note. He said, did you see there are now 20 Republican governor candidates that believe in the big lie. There are 20 Republican governor candidates who believe that the election was stolen.
It's going to hurt them, though, because they're going to probably lose in Pennsylvania. They're going to definitely lose in Michigan. Very good chance they're going to lose in Wisconsin, right? I mean, they are electing people that do not do well for them in the general election unless you're in a deep red state, and Arizona as well. And I know people are upset at Democrats for funneling money to these towards these far right to amp up these far right candidates. But if it is an effective general election strategy, then I don't care. Gloves off at election time to make it work.
I'm with you, John, on that. But I just want to point out that of those 20 believers in the big lie, that doesn't include Darren Bailey.
Darren Bailey is a little bit more nuanced. So he's been saying all along that there was fraud in the 2020 election, and then just sort of waving his hands around when asked what that meant, whether Joe Biden was the freely and properly elected president of the United States, which of course he was. Just recently in an interview with Mark Maswell of one of the St. Louis TV stations, he said that Joe Biden was properly elected. And, you know, whether he's doing that for electoral advantages just beyond me, but it's just such a small sort of concession to actually like the facts on the ground.
That's right. What I'm thinking. Why do we pat him on the back and say attaboy when he said Joe Biden won the election? How is that courageous or bold or anything?
Because it is
baby steps. Baby steps.
Oh, man.
Baby steps.
Yeah, he said Mike. And then the language that they use sometimes is really careful. Like they're looking for the back door even as they open the front door. He told reporter Mark Maxwell that Mike Pence followed the constitutional process and Joe Biden is the duly elected president. They hate to use the W word. Definite pivot, says Maxwell. Speaking of Darren Bailey, last time we minced, Bailey was playing defense for his comparison of abortion to the Holocaust. It was a 5-year-old video on Facebook, and Governor Pritzker's turned it into a campaign ad. As that story faded into the distance, his running mate is playing defense now for different 5-year-old social media comments. Stephanie Trussell made provocative anti-LGBTQ comments. Some of it was the sort of hot take you hear on right-wing radio. And in fact, she was a right-wing radio host here in Chicago, and I don't think she has to apologize for them. I would sort of answer the questions. I would tell people where I stand on some of the attendant issues, but I don't know that any of them were so hateful or incendiary that she needs to run away from them. But she's not only not responding to questions about them. Like Darren Bailey, she's not responding to much. She's not taking many questions at all. Now, what do you guys think about that? Should we be tracking down 5-year-old Facebook posts, and should we be making those campaign issues in 2022?
Yeah. What are we talking about, 5 years as an adult? If someone said it when they were 13 and they're 18, maybe not, right? You're a fully fledged adult saying something like that. That is fair game for criticism. You're fair to respond and say, hey, I don't think that way anymore. I've evolved. I'm all about forgiving people for evolving. If not, I would be in deep trouble here. But of course that's fair game.
Okay, maybe I put the emphasis on the wrong part then, John. 5 years when you're an adult, you're still an adult. Maybe it's the issue itself. I've got the quotes here. She said things like about transgender students' use of restrooms. She said, put your finger in the lock and your DNA will open the appropriate door. We are not interchangeable. Do you think Bruce, referring to Caitlyn Jenner, has true joy? She posted that Barack Obama was the first sitting president to address Planned Parenthood, repurposing classic stories to introduce gay characters. She wrote, what would they do if famous gay lesbian films were rewritten? Birdcage would be awesome if the Republican senator and his family were Christians and shared the good news of Jesus. The film could end with the gay couple getting saved. Satan is hunting our children. So she says crazy stuff like that. I don't even know what I just said.
Only on talk radio can you get that sort of incisive.
I also liked how she tweeted that Obama was always traveling, golfing, and advancing the gay agenda. And saying that Bill Clinton was called the first black president, can we call Obama the first gay president? And, right. And totally, five years ago is nothing when you're an adult. Let's ask her now for her to clarify this or to either walk it back or double down on it. I suspect she'll double down on it the way Bailey doubled down on his Holocaust abortion.
But what is disqualifying about it? Like, okay, so what you have is a Republican candidate who doesn't like the LGBTQ agenda. I don't even like the word agenda, but okay, that's not her team. She's going to run against that thing.
You're going to basically, people are going to judge based on, in some part, the character of the people being elected, and your past remarks are some reflection of your character and judgment. And I think the unfortunate thing for the Bailey campaign about those remarks is that they are spooky to a large portion of the persuadable middle that you need in order to win as a Republican in Illinois. Certainly, Darren Bailey's campaign was quite happy to bring up remarks that they thought would be toxic to the Republican base that Richard Irvin had said in his past. And I think he will have the same thing done to him and his running mate in the general.
And I would suggest that none of these remarks are indicative of what sort of policies a Bailey administration would pursue, but instead attack the essential humanity of gay and lesbian Illinois residents. And if that's not an issue for us to ask about, I don't know what is, because, you know, the governor can certainly direct how healthcare is provided to gay and lesbian Illinois residents and how they access services and how they get healthcare and mental health treatment and a whole host of things. And if the lieutenant governor is someone who does not believe that those people deserve equal protection of the law, that's, I believe, an absolutely reasonable thing for us to focus on. And the fact that neither Bailey nor Trussell will take questions from the news media, I think, is indicative that they have no real response to this. I do want to sort of mention that just the fact that these statements are sort of, you know, in the ether and being made and talking about is that it's I worry about the damage just done. I mean, the whole phrase Planned Parenthood at a time when healthcare and reproductive rights, it's such an incendiary statement to be made without any sort of like context or appropriate sort of just explanation. And it's just, you know, it just sort of, it just sort of, you know, I've got like a pit in my stomach every time somebody says it, because there's just so much to unpack there and so much real damage to be done if we treat this sort of questioning of people's humanity as sort of just a debate talking point or sort of something to be used for political gain. I think it's just really damaging to a whole host of people.
There's a leader in my state feel like I should be able to be married to my husband and own a home together with him. That's pretty important. I feel like that's
I don't know the answer. And how do you know how he would answer that question, by the way, John?
Darren
Bailey? I don't. Yeah.
He'd dance around it right now. Or he'd say that's settled law. That's the law of the land. But guess what? Right. It may not be, right? Like, so yeah, that matters to me, and it should. And if you have a gay friend or someone in your family that is, that's totally fair game. It's a very basic question, too.
Yeah, I also think that we're also in a situation where several times now Darren Bailey has said different things to different reporters. So he's been in Chicago and he's said nice things about Chicago. He's been downstate and he's, you know, basically said that Chicago is a hellhole that is in need of like immediate federal intervention.
What was the nice thing he said about Chicago? I think the only nice thing he said was that it's
not
he didn't double down on the hellhole.
Well, he called it a great city that just needed a little bit of help. So that's different than a hellhole. So I think you're going to see a lot of emphasis from the Pritzker campaign and independent expenditures, not only sort of criticizing Darren Bailey for what he's saying, but for the fact that he seems to be sort of, you know, speaking differently to different audiences. And we heard that sort of attack previewed by the mayor a few weeks ago at a very rare joint appearance with the with the governor. And that sort of that whole approach, I think, is going to be more and more used as, you know, sort of a proxy way to talk about these incendiary statements without sort of putting the humanity of mm-hmm. LGBTQ people up for debate, because that shouldn't be up for debate.
I just wonder, I mean, we're talking about this race and it's occupying some brain space. Is it even going to be close? Is it one of these races like where you're talking like the first congressional district where it's just the outcome is just foreordained at this point? Yeah. That Bailey seems like he's such a bad candidate, and it just doesn't. I don't see a path to victory for him at all right now. I usually don't like it when candidates don't debate, but I could see Pritzker just saying, this guy's a nut. I'm not going to debate him.
Not share the stage. Don't dignify the stage with his presence. Austin, you were about to say something. What was that?
Obviously, they should be held accountable for their remarks. The Pritzker campaign has known since this ticket was announced the record and the Oppo research on these two candidates. And they chose to spend $20 million to increase the odds that they were the Republican nominee. And as John said, you know, all's fair in politics. There are knock-on collateral effects, though, of doing this. And one of them is that there are people in Illinois who may think that some of these things being said in these Facebook posts, because a person of some sort of stature, the Republican lieutenant governor nominee, is saying them, that, you know, those are worthy of consideration, or that those are even a mainstream view with a lot of the state, which I would argue that it is not. So there are effects of that. Even if Bailey were to lose, there's a lot of news coverage. There's a lot of talk around some of these remarks that could be hurtful to a lot of people.
Right. I think Austin brings up a good point. Does Darren, let's assume Darren Bailey loses by 30, 35 points, you know, be that as it may, does his candidacy serve as sort of a shifting of the Overton window, much in the same ways that Jeannie Ives' nearly successful primary campaign against Bruce Rauner, you know, 4 years ago, really sort of was the you know, signal that the Republican Party was changing, not only in Illinois, but nationwide, but really set the stage for Darren Bailey to win the nomination. And if we've moved sort of that window of acceptable discourse this far, what happens, you know, 6 months from now, a year from now, 2 years from now, and what impact does that have on the most vulnerable people in Illinois? And that, I don't think any of us know the answer to that question.
You know, I'm wondering too, is why do these people want run? Presumably because you want to be governor. How do you think, saying those things, being those people you are in this blue state, how do you think you could possibly win? Well, then I would try and talk my way into office. I would, you know, buy campaign ads for sure, but I would be given interviews. I would be, you know, advertising. I would be trying to influence people. I would come on the radio. I would do TV interviews, even if this was the thing that came up. For instance, we said to Trussell, we said, hey, listen, we heard what you posted 5 years ago. Come on, give us some context, tell you how I feel about that. What did that mean? And what do you mean now? And then we'll talk about the issues you say are important, the economy and violence. So we'll do that. And they just sent a printed statement. No phone call, no interview, no nothing. How do you think you're going to win? And you must think you're not going to win, but then why are you even running? I don't understand why these people are running, or why they're running the way they are, right? Why won't they do interviews? Well, why won't they talk?
Because they believe what they said, and they don't like to try and paint it in a different way. Maybe.
Dilute the awfulness of it with some other version of it, huh?
Maybe. I agree. Yeah, I think it's an easy cleanup too, right? Like cleanups can gain you points in politics to show that you have made mistakes and you've evolved and you can appear to be more mainstream.
That's what I was giving them a chance.
Exactly. So if they don't want to do that, then they must believe what they said and they don't want to sully it.
Well, I think you could have asked the same question about, well, why did Darren Bailey do the things that he did at the height of the pandemic, right? Why did he refuse to wear a mask on the floor when they were meeting remotely? And why was he, you know, why did he force security to escort him off? Well, obviously, he did it because he, you know, on some level, because it helped raise his profile. So then the question is, you know, is he hoping against hope? Maybe he pulls off a massive, you know, come from behind, you know, black horse victory, or it is just the act of running enough to raise his profile in a way that it will increase his social media following, or it will sort of, you know, make him somebody who's invited to speak at these right-wing conferences, or sort of what benefit is. And I think it's not just running for, you know, it's not just running for office. It's everything that comes along with that and that spotlight.
And I think Heather brings up a great point. In these people that say they made their own beds trying to get the attention of other people, even if they were trying to be shocking on the radio. Well, guess what? Consequences are being met right now, right? Like this is what you get. You played that game and here you are. So I don't feel bad for you that we get to ask these questions now. And maybe that's it. You know, if you're willing to put yourself out there and try and get people to notice what you're doing by being as shocking or as crazy or as against the norm as normal, well, guess what? This is what happens next.
Normal gets to vote. Naperville passed by an 8-1 vote an ordinance banning the sale of some high-powered rifles, including AR-15s and corresponding ammunition. Handgun sales would still be allowed at the couple of gun stores in Naperville. The dissenting councilman said the ban does no good and opens the city to millions of dollars worth of lawsuits. He preferred some sort of resolution where the council would make a statement rather than banning the sale of high-powered rifles. Do we agree that the ban does not reduce the number of guns on the streets? Doesn't make Naperville necessarily safer? And does open them up to lawsuits that could cost them millions? Austin, why don't you go first? What's your thought about what they did and what this one councilman thinks they're getting themselves into?
Well, I think it's definitely a case of sort of, obviously we had a horrible tragedy in Illinois, but it's certainly a national wave being localized. So people are saying, hey, I can't get this stuff done in Congress. I can't get this stuff done in state government. There's not been a special session called on any of this stuff. Let me try to do something at my city council, right? So that's what obviously many of these people were trying to do in Naperville. I haven't seen any good research on what the effects of local assault weapons bans are. The research on the federal assault weapons ban, I would say, is mixed. So I think unclear of whether this will have any kind of effect locally on crime or access to weapons among people who want to get them in Naperville. So I would say it's unclear.
I would go further than that and say I think that this is a symbolic resolution that will have no practical effect whatsoever, besides perhaps hurting this person's business. That people who want to buy these weapons often have access to cars or public transportation and can go to places and buy them. And you are opening yourself up to lawsuits. But again, I don't feel like the symbolism is wrong, is bad. That it is a statement from this community, just like in Highland Park. Passed a resolution. I don't think it had any. I think there's already an assault weapons ban in Highland Park. There's been one for a while. I think they just passed a resolution sort of underscoring that and calling for a statewide ban. That a ban like this would have to be federal, the way it was back in the 90s. Or was it the 80s? No, it was the 90s, wasn't it?
90s.
I think that, as Austin says, the research is mixed. I think there was a reduction in mass shootings during that time. Again, I don't know how statistically significant it was. Most killings by guns, the vast majority of killings by guns, are not done by these AR-15 style weapons. They're done with handguns. So you're talking about a resolution that is aimed at expressing the horror that we all feel at these mass shootings, but it's not. That's really not the gun problem in this country. The gun problem in this country are the handguns that are killing people by the score all the time.
But it's a gun problem. I mean, pick the weapon, and we happen to pick this one. This is the one that's used in mass shootings. Handguns are not used in mass shootings. It is these high-powered rifles. I like the symbolism of it, if nothing else, Eric, right? I mean, it's sort of like, you know what? I'm not going to take it anymore. I don't care if this doesn't affect great change. It doesn't affect great harm, and I'm all for it. So, you know, I mean, if the only voice you have is local Austin, then speak it there, right?
I really can't begrudge people for trying to take action with their local government when they're feeling, you know, there's nothing else getting done. But yeah, I tend to agree with Eric that this is mostly symbolic. Hopefully they'll pursue other, maybe more evidence-based things to reduce gun violence in their local community. And hopefully people are also doing those things and not simply relying on measures like this.
Right. How would you have voted on it, Austin?
I think it would depend on what my constituents were saying. That's the idea of the benefit being almost negligible to none, except people feeling like they've done something, and the cost being perhaps someone loses their business. I think that's a very tough choice because the cost is quite clear and, and the benefit is not.
So far you're abstaining. I vote with the majority, 8-1. Eric, how do you vote on this?
I would vote with the majority, but I would probably couch my vote with some sort of statement like the one Austin made, which is like, I value the symbolism here, but I'm so I'm going along with it, but I don't expect this to make any real difference.
But does a journalist, Heather, cast a vote in this, or are you abstaining with the journalistic...
Yeah, from the press table, I'd be furiously working on an article about how this is another indication that the politics of guns is very different in the Naperville of 2022 than the Naperville of my youth or even 10 years ago. Because if you had told me 10 years ago that Naperville was going to follow Highland Park in passing an assault weapons ban, I would have said, please lay off the drugs. I love you. You don't have to live this way.
What are you saying, that Highland Park is or that Naperville has changed how?
Well, it is far more liberal than it was 10 years ago.
I never thought of it as anything but, I guess.
Oh, John, growing up in DuPage County.
That's right. Okay, fair enough.
No, I was just going to say that the fact that, there are eight Naperville City Council members who feel like this is a smart political move for them to make, I think is a representation that the politics of this has changed significantly after Sandy Hook and Uvalde and Parkland and Highland Park, and I could go on and on. But I also think that Chicago is the best evidence anywhere that local bans on guns do not work, because we hear day in and day out essentially that, you know, the majority of the guns that are used in crimes in Chicago come from Indiana, where there basically is no gun control, and that it's not really an effective technique to say, well, you can't buy them in Naperville, but you can buy them in Wheaton, when literally all you have to do is cross the street.
Yeah.
So that, I think, is going to, you know, people are going to, you know, sort of do these act locally, but there's going to be increasing pressure on federal office holders to address this with a federal solution. And of course, we all know that that's all gridlocked. But I do think it's at least noteworthy that this is such a no-brainer right now for people in the suburbs, where we all know has been sort of the focus of political attention and activism since 2018, that this is what people want to do. And I think that will have ramifications in the midterms coming up in November.
How are you voting, John?
Symbols matter, as long as they're the introduction, not the epilogue. And I cast a vote of aye.
I wonder what the consequences will be for those elder people. I suppose if they are representing their constituents, Austin, they will be. In fact, one of the last comments in the press I read about this was the people standing up there saying, we're going to remember this come election time. And the councilman said, every one of us is fully aware that we will be held accountable for our actions. And I don't know if he felt by that, I will get reelected, or you'll forget, or this is going to hurt my chances. I don't know why people want to be a city councilman anyway. So maybe he's like, fine, vote me out.
And this would be my perennial plug to change the election calendar so that municipal elections in Illinois are not when no one votes in February of off presidential years. And maybe we should have these city council members stand to vote, say when we're voting for in November.
I like that.
Bailey or Pritzker.
Imagine that. About the search and seizure of documents and golf balls at Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate, the former president is saying that he may have declassified them anyway, or that they could have asked for them and he would have given them to him, or that Barack Hussein Obama did all of this and then some. What about his 33 million documents that Obama stole off with? And on and on and on he goes. We have seen a description of what the FBI confiscated, but not much more detail about all of this. Eric, where does this story go next? How much is this going to cost Donald Trump?
Well, where it goes next is, I believe, on Friday or Thursday. I'm not sure when it's going to happen, but this week sometime there's going to be a hearing in which I think it's the news media that's pressing for the release of the affidavit, which it was the predicate for the warrant. And the U.S. Justice Department, Department of Justice, is fighting this because they said this will expose what's going on in their investigation, including some of their sources. And this is highly unusual, in fact, maybe even unprecedented, to have an affidavit, a search warrant affidavit, be released at this point in the investigation. That's where it's going right now. If that affidavit is released, you can expect there to be some retribution from Trump to the people who may have informed on him or pointed the FBI, the Department of Justice, toward Mar-a-Lago, that he has these documents there. And I do think, well, first of all, you're right to point out that he's got these evolving explanations and excuses. The stuff about Obama having done it, the National Archive has said, no, that's absolutely not true. That's not how Obama handled these informations. The fact that he said that he unilaterally declassified them, that's not how it works. That declassifying documents, yes, presidents can do that, but they can do it unilaterally, but there's paperwork that has to be done. You can't just say everything that I have is automatically declassified. And also that's kind of absurd, because that would mean that all that information would be publicly available. So all these explanations that he's been offering seem wrong. What seems to be what happened was that they were trying to get these documents back from him. They tried the normal way of asking nicely and subpoenaing them, and they didn't get them. And then so they had to go in. And what seemed like, I mean, we use the word raid, but it was just a fairly peaceful execution of a search warrant where they went in and I guess they filmed the whole thing. I think Trump's lawyer was there. I think that there's certainly a small segment of the population that's really outraged and really concerned about this. I think most people are in the let's wait and see where this goes camp right now. Let's see what he had, why he had it, and if he was breaking the law that he wanted Hillary Clinton locked up for.
Yeah, no kidding. I kind of wonder how it even happens. If in a box he has top secret documents that he's not supposed to have, that he didn't turn in, then isn't he guilty? Like, I could figure this out in about 20 minutes.
You would have to prove intent. You'd have to. And I had Michael Leonard, who's a federal defense attorney, on Let's Get Legal, plug of the show, last weekend. He'll be on this weekend, too, at 1 o'clock on WGN. And we dove deep into this, the idea of, you know, what the government would have to prove about the documents, that he knowingly did them, that there was some malicious intent, perhaps, of having the documents there. And I think where this is going is a big, fat nothing burger. Not that what he did wasn't wrong and having the documents wasn't good, but I viewed this as the start of something. I think a lot of people feel like this is the beginning or this is the middle part of something. But Michael Leonard, you know, made the great point that there's a very good chance the Department of Justice wanted these documents back. They were not given to them back. They went in and got them, and they're satisfied. And that's the end of this. As long as they go through the document, and that's what one argument is, and that I think that would anger a lot of people on both sides that have built this into something bigger, or that are the people might be more outraged. Heather, did I say something wrong?
I don't think the evidence supports that, and I'm certainly not an expert. I only play one on podcasts, but I think the fact that we know that the search warrant cited the Espionage Act and cited parts of the Espionage Act where they sought to conceal or destroy documents, I think that is an indication that this was not just about getting the documents back.
Fair.
And I think the fact that the Department of Justice went through what seems to me to be a somewhat deliberative process of saying, excuse me, former President Trump, you seem to have left with some of our documents. Could we have them back? Please, can we have them back? Hey, here's a subpoena. Can we Can we please have these back? Okay, you know what? We're going to come down and would you show us where the documents are? And can we have, oh, wait, and we're going to get you a subpoena for the security camera footage that looks at the door to where the documents are. And then we're going to go get a search warrant to go get the documents. That does not seem to me to be solely focused on getting the documents back.
Can I clarify? Because it was Michael Leonard's point, not mine. I don't want to put words in his mouth. His point that everything you say may be correct and that there may be further investigation that's done, but it may not lead to any indictment because of the, and this is a whole separate discussion about the delicacy of this situation, that laws may have been broken more so than what we know right now, but that the Department of Justice will say this is not enough to bring the former president under indictment, or that we'd be able to prove to a jury of 12 people beyond unreasonable doubt that the former president had evidence or had knowledge of all that. It just may be too hard of a case to prove. Your point is fully taken, but that was the point that Michael Leonard was making.
It may be, and of course, politically speaking, there was never any allegation that Hillary Clinton had taken the classified information that was on her laptop and done anything with it, or even knew that she had it there. And this was the very offense that the entire Republican Party was ululating that they should lock her up in 2016. So I think that hypocrisy is not going to play well, again, with people who are really honest brokers here and looking at this going, well, you know, was this something reasonable? Like, hey, did they just move some boxes down there? And hey, it happened. Sometimes stuff gets mixed up and we had boxes we didn't know. And it's been a long time since Trump's been out of the White House. And it's been a long time since they've been asking for these documents back. You know, I would obviously defer to a former federal prosecutor, and Trump has wriggled out of every single little dilemma and contretemps that he's been in. So it seems reasonable that he'll wriggle out of this one as well. But it does strike me as a non-trivial thing that's happened here, that this guy thinks that he is above the law. And that's why I think it's so important to pursue this and to indict him if he's indictable. We have people in prison now for offenses that are less flagrant than this. And if we just say, oh, he's above the law because we're afraid that the feelings of his supporters are going to be hurt and they're going to be mad, you can't run a country that way. You can't run a legal system that way.
So I know I've said this on the podcast before, but had I come on this podcast 3 weeks ago and said, you know what, I think the investigation into the documents that Trump took to Mar-a-Lago is really going to explode and is going to be a significant point of legal peril, you guys would have pointed and laughed at me. You'd have been, Heather, come on, get with it. And the fact of the matter is that we don't know what we don't know. Federal prosecutors do not tell us what they are working on, how they are working on it, or what investigative steps that we're taking. So we are all flying blind. So all we can do is rely on the actual documents that have been released in public, which was why I was emphasizing the parts of the Espionage Act that the government used to get the search warrant. We have no idea what they're doing. We have so little visibility into this. And I would be shocked if the judge on Thursday releases the search warrant affidavit because he says the government says there are confidential informants that could impede not just this investigation, but other investigations. We are looking at, I think, what might be, we're looking at an iceberg. We are seeing only the very top of it. Is it possible that it is just a very tiny, tiny ice flow and not even really an iceberg? Sure. Is it possible that it is a massive iceberg, the likes of which that has not been seen since the sinking of the Titanic? Absolutely. We just don't know. And we saw this in Illinois all the time. How many people said Michael Madigan would never be indicted? He was indicted. How many people said that Ed Burke would never be indicted? Indicted. So, it's human nature, I think, to want to speculate and to want to know. But there's just so much that we don't know about where this investigation is going or even really what it's looking for.
To Eric and John's point, I do think, say you give, we know some things, and say you give Trump the benefit of the doubt on those things. So you give him the benefit of the doubt on he had the standing order as president where basically anything he took to Mar-a-Lago was declassified. You have the unilateral authority to declassify things as president, so you're not convicted under Espionage Act. And say it's impossible to convict him on mens rea. We don't know if he had intention or knowledge of wrongdoing. So willfully concealing documents, he's not convicted on that either. It's still just based on what we know now, further evidence of, that he's not the sort of person who should be holding political power. And because on its face, just given the things that we know, it's as reckless, if not more, than what Hillary Clinton did when she was Secretary of State. When Comey said that she had very sensitive classified information and was, quote, extremely careless, this was the exact same sort of behavior with documents that, based on what we know about what was seized, had a higher level of classification than the ones that were referenced in the Clinton email scandal. Even giving him the benefit of the doubt, even if it is just an ice flow, there's no iceberg, I still think it is a really, really significant thing.
So you would say that
Austin makes a really good point. There's a political portion to this and whether or not it means that Donald Trump is not qualified to be president again. And then there's a legal portion of this with, you know, is he in legal jeopardy? And I think those are two separate issues mm-hmm. that get conflated a lot.
Fair
Sorry,
enough.
Jeff, I jumped in.
No, I was going to say that even if the standard, you know, we're not even talking about the criminal prosecution thereof or charges, if the standard was this, that Hillary should not hold office because of her careless use of the documents, should the same standard be applied should Trump run again? I think that's a fair and nuanced argument, which means it's going to go great.
Well, my answer to the question of if they can do this to the president, they can do this to anybody. And I thought, yeah, they should do this to anybody. In fact, they should especially do it to the president. I don't have access to this stuff. I don't have the power to compromise national security. The president does. So, yeah, we should prosecute or pursue this. Absolutely. I would hate, Eric, to see them sort of carve out something where the Justice Department says, okay, we got the documents back, so let's not waste any more time on this. I absolutely want them to waste time on this.
Really?
I guess I do too, just for the symbolism of that no person is above the law, that you can't say, well, like I said, you can't say he's popular and so this is going to upset people. The law gets into trouble every time that it puts its finger to the wind of public opinion and tries to indict someone who's been accused of a horrible crime, even though they don't have the evidence because they want to solve the case. Anytime that blindfold slips off Dame Justice, you got problems.
Prosecutors use discretion all the time, and we value that. In fact, sometimes it's celebrated as something that prosecutors will weigh the side of not charging someone because of the effects that it may have. And that's always been a part of how our justice system works. I don't mind a careful examination of what it could potentially do to an already divided country. I don't mind them weighing that as a consideration. And I would love to pretend that every person is created equal. And I have no problem with them pursuing that. And justice should be blind, but it isn't. And there is some benefit to that. And if a local prosecutor weighs that, then so should the Department of Justice, with a country coming apart at the seams.
But they make these decisions. Prosecutors make these decisions, or we want them to make these decisions, based on the individual who's charged and on the crime that's committed, and what sort of the broader demands of justice require, not what public opinion wants. That you could take, you know, I mean, I certainly covered a number of cases when I was writing a column with the Tribune of wrongful convictions, and a lot of them were rooted in the fact that prosecutors were inflamed by a particular crime and they wanted someone to pay for it. It's what you've seen in some of these police torture cases where the cops think they know what they've got and everyone is trying to settle the public down and bring charges, and the people were actually innocent. So you don't want prosecutors making their discretionary decisions based on those kind of factors. So, you know, I understand what you're saying, that this could make things worse, but I think they can make, if they can make a good case that Trump violated these laws, and then they just say, oh, it doesn't matter, go ahead, that's just like carte blanche to the next would-be autocrat who becomes president of the United States.
So you're trying to afford Donald Trump the sort of protection that Hillary Clinton didn't have from James Comey, right?
She didn't get prosecuted.
James Comey certainly inserted himself into the political process.
Well, with the statement, right. I mean,
Yeah, I think that's a different issue, though, because FBI rules say you don't talk about an investigation until somebody's charged. He violated that.
Well, so did Merrick Garland, then, technically, and the DOJ.
I think if you go very carefully and you listen to Merrick Garland's statement, he said nothing about whether anybody should be charged or would be charged. He merely said, look, we know there's a lot of attention on this issue.
Fair.
We are not going to oppose that this specific document be released because of the high level of attention. Also, let's keep in mind that in the last, week or so, a man has attacked the FBI office in Cincinnati. A person has died by suicide in front of the Capitol building, and that there have been at least 3 or 4 people arrested after making concerted threats against FBI agents for executing the search warrant. And I think Merrick Garland's statement that the FBI is moving forward without fear or favor and with no political agenda, I cannot be read as inserting himself into sort of a statement of fact of, former President Trump's guilt or lack thereof.
Does this deserve a statement, though, if they end up not charging him with anything? Doesn't the country need something like that from Merrick Garland?
So that's how Jim Comey got hosed, essentially.
Yep.
And it's a really complicated issue. But you can argue that, the FBI's rules say if we don't charge somebody, we have spoken.
Right.
I would like to ask Heather, as an observer of City Hall, what she makes of Alderman Sophia King's entry into the mayor's race and how that might change the way that race shapes up, which the election is, of course, next February. But she seems like she might be a plausible candidate.
I think she is a plausible candidate. She has a relatively unique path to city council. She was appointed by former Mayor Rahm Emanuel back in 2016 and has since won 2 elections to represent the 4th Ward, which includes Hyde Park and Kenwood. And she and her husband are good friends of the Obamas. They go way back. And President Barack Obama's actual first political act after leaving office was to endorse her city council bid. So I think any time in Chicago where you say you can link a candidate to Obama, you have to take them seriously. I also think that it is not by mistake that when Alderman Roderick Sawyer entered the mayor's race, the Mayor Lightfoot's reaction was, another day, another man who thinks he can do this job better than me. She can't make that argument against Sophia King. And, on the city council, Sophia King has been a quiet but persistent critic of the mayor. She pushed to have Lakeshore Drive renamed in honor of Jean-Baptiste Pointe du Sable. She has criticized the mayor for not moving fast enough on the $15 minimum wage several years ago. And she has been critical, as really has all of the candidates, about her approach, that combative approach Lightfoot has leaned into. So if Sophia King can make the argument that she can be sort of an actually progressive mayor who can get things done without sort of the drama that has sort of followed Lori Lightfoot around, I think that's an argument to be made. I also think that if Chicago's progressive community, so that's the Chicago's Teachers Union, that's United Working Families, that's all of that coalition of group, if they can get behind one candidate the way that they got behind Delia Ramirez in the 3rd congressional district race, that could really have an impact on how this race shapes up. And keep in mind, we're likely to have close to a dozen candidates on the February ballot, which means that you're going to need somewhere in the neighborhood of 15% to 20% to get into a runoff. So if it's Lori Lightfoot versus the candidate chosen by Chicago's progressive community, that's a much different race than if it's Lori Lightfoot versus a conservative candidate like Paul Vallis or Raymond Lopez or Willie Wilson. And I think that's what progressive groups across the city are now sitting down and looking at, because you know, it's time is ticking. So it's got to, you know, people are going to have to sort of put up or shut up by Labor Day. And that includes Jesus Chuy Garcia. If he's going to run, he's got to decide pretty soon. So if there's one candidate that can sort of claim that progressive mantle to challenge Lori Lightfoot from the left, that I think it would be really interesting.
Wow. No further questions.
Only thing I would add, I think Heather's point to watch what CTU does is really interesting, and they're going to be the biggest player in all of this. I'm working on a super secret project that I will discuss later about CTU, ooh, but their influence on city and county and state and now the federal government is only growing. And we're going to have I think it has to be a record number of incumbents who are not going to be running for seats in the city council. So you've got Michelle Smith who resigned. You've got Kappelman not running, Osterman not running, Kerry Austin not running, maybe Tom Tunney not running. We don't know. I don't think yet. Roderick Sawyer and Ray Lopez are both not running because they're going to be running for mayor. All of those seats are very, you know, not that many people vote for those city council seats. And that means CTU can come in with a lot of manpower and muscle and get their people elected. They just got, you know, in 2019, they had five members of the Democratic Socialists of America elected with their backing of the CTU and United Working Families. So we could see another really extreme leftward shift in the city council, regardless of what goes down in the mayor's race.
Yeah, I'm not actually convinced it's going to be sort of like this massive exodus from the city council. You know, in 2011, there were huge people who saw Daley not run and decided to get out of town. You know, that I think probably would have happened this term anyway, because I doubt Rahm Emanuel would have served more than three terms if he had run for a third term. So I think a lot of the people like Michelle Smith and Harry Osterman and James Kappelman are just sort of coming to the natural end of their city council careers. But on the other hand, Austin, you're 100% right, because there's no doubt that like the Democratic Socialists see these departures as ways to boost their numbers on the city council. There are socialist candidates already running in the 48th ward and the 46th ward and the 15th ward. So we'll see more of those. However, do I think that all of the aldermen who are running for mayor will stay running for mayor? I do not. I think that a bunch of them, if not most of them, will, you know, reconsider that plan and at the last minute-ish decide to keep their seat on the city council. So that's my
guess. And people are talking about Jesse Sharkey, the outgoing president of the Chicago Teachers Union, and Stacey Davis Gates, the president of the union, either one of them jumping into the race. Does Sophia King's entry into the race maybe diminish the chances that either of those two will jump in, that they will decide as a union that they will get behind a certain candidate and not jump in themselves?
I think this is sort of what happened after Donald Trump was elected president, right? Everybody was like, wait, Donald Trump was elected president? I could be elected president. I'm going to run. And I think a lot of people had that reaction to Lori Lightfoot becoming mayor, because in August of 2018, had I said, yep, it's going to be Lori Lightfoot, they would have been like, oh, you sweet summer child, you're crazy. So I think a lot of people are saying she won, maybe lightning will strike me. And I think a lot of people are sort of kicking the tires on that, because there's always the chance in Chicago that once somebody's elected mayor, they're elected mayor for the next generation, and nobody wants to miss their opening.
Yeah.
I tend to think that, CTU is going to be a player in this election one way or the other. I don't know if they're going to get a player by nominating one of their own or somebody else. I think somebody else who's considering a run is Brandon Johnson on the Cook County Board of Commissioners, and he's very close to CTU, and I don't think he's somebody to be discounted yet.
Boy, that race makes me want lightning to strike me, I'll tell you that much.
Well, if I were going to run for mayor, I would put out a video where I'm grocery shopping for crudité. I would hold up a 12-pound bag of carrots and say, this is Lori Lightfoot's fault, the way Dr. Oz was blaming the expense of his vegetable platter on Joe Biden. From when did that video?
Shot it April. In April, yeah.
From April. The magic of social media.
I thought I'd do some grocery shopping. I'm at Wegner's, and my wife wants some vegetables for crudité, right? So here's a broccoli. That's $2. not a ton of broccoli there. There's some asparagus. That's $4. Yep. Carrots. That's $4 more. That's $10 of vegetables there. And then we need some guacamole. That's $4 more. And she loves salsa. Yeah, there's salsa there. $6. Must be a shortage of salsa. Guys, that's $20 for crudité. And this doesn't include the tequila. I mean, that's outrageous. And we got Joe Biden to thank for this.
For some reason, that thing has surfaced on everybody's feeds now. And everybody's watching this ridiculous 35-second video where Dr. Oz is demonstrating how expensive it is for him and his wife to have crudité in Pennsylvania, and he goes grocery shopping.
Can I tell you my favorite part of this was that Fetterman, John Fetterman, the Democratic candidate in the race, went so far as to create a fake Twitter account from a fake grocery store because Dr. Oz in that video gets the name of the grocery store that he's in wrong.
Wegmans,
he combines
or Wegmans
a Jersey grocery store with a Pennsylvania grocery store. So they created a whole new grocery store that was like trolling Dr. Oz, and Dr. Oz's campaign responded to the fake grocery store. And that's when you know that you have lost the social media primary.
It's so much fun to watch, and I always see people on Twitter after he tweets something like that. All right, enough about the Jersey thing, enough about this. Talk about the issues. Boy, those people are wrong.
If I've seen that message of Dr. Oz isn't from Pennsylvania more than I've ever seen any single message for any state candidate in any state race, including Illinois. So that you know that it's penetrating in
It reminds me of when Barack Obama referred to the price of arugula, if you remember, and he was widely mocked. So I think the crudité mistake by Dr. Oz is going to hurt him.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Nice to see you, John Hanson. You haven't been able to join us on the podcast in a while. You look good, my friend.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Congratulations on the purchase of your new domicile. How exciting.
Well, you know, it's always in this period where you never know where it could happen. So maybe I'll be in Roscoe Village longer than I realize.
Hey, are we going to see Brandon again? I know he's really busy with his show.
You mean the show I'm also on?
Yeah. Yes. He's the host, John. Come on. He's the big shot host.
I got to talk to my agent about that. No, he'll be back soon. He misses you all. He sends his love.
Yeah, we really miss him, too. So.
We'll have conversations with you, John, about last-minute real estate deals that blew up or unrealistic asks at the closing. When we sold our last house, there were some nail holes where things had been hung, so we took everything down. And we did everything that the person who was buying our place wanted. And our place was a good place in good shape. It was a good deal for her. But she said at close, I want $500 to fix the nail holes. And you're like, all right, I really want this deal to close. But she just had her hand in my pocket. And I'm like, all right, here, take $500.
We're done.
I need to leave this office with a signed contract. So, yeah, $500.
You should have rolled up each individual one and put it in a nail hole. You can find it in the wall.
She should have asked for $1,000. I mean, what the hell? If you're going to rob me, go for it all. Go for broke. All right, guys. Well, we'll talk to some of you, hopefully all of you, next week. Thanks for being part of the pod.
Thank you all.
Great
That's
to see
Austin
you all.
Berg,
Hi,
Heather
friends.
Sharon.
Hey, John, tell your dad congratulations on his retirement.
Oh, yeah. That was awesome.
That was cool.
Yeah.
Go Lincoln Wood, yes, 32 years. The only chief that's ever served there.
How about that? Whoa. John Hanson, Eric Zorn. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. And we will drop another podcast on you next week.
Thanks, everybody. That was really fun.
Thank
that
you
was
all.
Fun. Bye.
Jeez, good seeing you.
Take care.
Thanks, John.
Yeah, thanks for letting me hop on. I appreciate it.
Oh, man. Anytime.
I always like it, so I was sitting around doing nothing.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.